Hey, I'm Jake Brennan, and I want to tell you about Disgraceland, the award-winning music and true crime podcast that I host. Disgraceland tells the stories of musicians getting away with murder and behaving very badly. Fleetwood Mac, Nipsey Hussle, Cardi B, Ozzy Osbourne, Taylor Swift, Tupac, The Beatles, Amy Winehouse, Jay-Z, The Grateful Dead, and so many more. This is not the music history you've heard before. This is an uncensored, immersive look at the lives of musical icons as seen through the crimes they've committed or that have been perpetrated against them. Did Jerry Lee Lewis murder his fifth wife? What really happened to Sam Cooke in that seedy motel at 3 a.m.? And how did the Rolling Stones wind up sleeping with the First Lady? Wait, what? New episodes of Disgraceland drop every Tuesday with bonus episodes released on Mondays and Thursdays. So get in, buckle up, and join me in Disgraceland. Available right now, wherever you get your podcasts. Rock and roll.
I guess the sun came out in Manchester as opposed to it just being kind of, you know, cloudy all the time, and all of a sudden people were waving like glow sticks and it just changed from kind of, you know, everything that we still know and love and everything, but to just something that was a bit more modern psychedelic, I suppose.
Hi, this is Lowell Tolhurst, co-founder of The Cure.
This is Budgie, co-founder of The Creatures, drummer with The Slits, and Susie and the Banshees.
Welcome to Curious Creatures.
Life after punk.
You may think you know the territory,
but we drew the map.
So, today we have, as our guest, Mr. Tim Burgess. He's obviously the singer in the Charlatans.
Yes, the harmonica player.
And I didn't know that, but yes, he is.
Share a love, a mutual respect for the harmonica. Man. I love the harmonica. I play the harmonica.
Yeah, you do. Yeah. And he's also an author of several books.
He is.
The other thing that Tim is famous for at the moment, in the last couple of years when we've all had to endure, you know, the pandemic, he sort of single-handedly rallied the troops together for music with his Tim's Twitter listening parties. And I believe that you've done one or two of them. I've done a couple myself.
You've done a couple. I've done one. We did Kaleidoscope, I believe. That was the one. It's just a great thing. I mean, he's had some big names on there, hasn't he?
Oh, yeah. And it's actually more exciting than it seems on paper, because if you say to people, well, what is the listening party? And I say, well, everybody that's on Twitter at the time can put the album on that you have the listening party for and listen to it, and somebody from the band or involved with the music will explain all the songs and give you little anecdotes and photos as you go along. And they say, well, that doesn't sound like it would be that tremendous, but it's really exciting. Yeah. And people really responded to it. So he sort of single-handedly kept that going, you know, why everybody was in lockdown.
So should we bring him in, Lowell? Should we bring?
I think we better.
Timothy Alan Burgess, This Is Your Life.
Fantastic. Wow.
Yes.
I'm already thrilled. Yeah.
One thing we wanted to ask you about, because we realized we weren't in England, either me or Budgie, for the 90s at all. You know, we were like here, Budgie was in, Budgie was here as well for a while, and then he was in Berlin, and then he was in France and stuff. So we weren't in England, and so we missed the 90s. We don't really know what went on. So sort of outline for us, if you can, we won't make it too difficult, but, you know, your journey from the time you started making music, because we always want to know about how people start, you know, and what inspired them and how they felt just, you know, starting on this journey that brings us all here at this point, you know.
My journey started in 1978 with a record that I'd asked for, but my nan from Bolton bought me Love Bites by the Buzzcocks.
Wow.
As a Christmas present. And that was my first memory of anything apart from little Jimmy Osmond. So that was the first proper record that I was into.
Long-haired lover from Liverpool. That was
that was me, age six.
I read on Wikipedia. Can you believe anything on Wikipedia? Not if you can, if mine's anything to be judged by. It said Northwich.
Yeah.
Was voted in 2014 the best place to live in the UK by the Sunday Times.
Wow. That is insane because, I mean, last time I was there, which was actually 2018, maybe, it was just like really struggling. So, grim. Yeah, like no, you know, I mean, because obviously, you know, I grew up there and it was kind of, you know, just a buzzing small town, really, record shops and Woolworths and, you know, all the great shops. And, and the shopping precinct has not been replaced by anything. I think there's four butchers.
Wow.
And it's like, who eats that amount of meat?
They're at each other's throats.
And nothing else. All the shops next, you know, there's just nothing else. It's crazy.
Yeah. I don't go back to where I was born. I believe in not. Crawley, you know, it's like one of those 1950s new towns after the Second World War. You know, it's like, it's kind of soulless, to be honest. You know, yeah. I got this book of boring postcards, you know, they all look exactly the same, you know.
But, yeah, so what happened, really? Manchester, really, I was very interested in Manchester music. I was, you know, I guess a kid who got let in the back door and all of a sudden, I was, instead of watching bands, I was on stage, sort of like singing, doing my thing, and they've not told me to get off yet. So that's kind of it. But it started for me in Manchester in the late 80s, and I was going to the Hacienda a lot, and all of a sudden, I was going to indie nights, and then on the Friday and Saturdays, it was all about. There were club nights, so it was all like, you know, acid house and things like that. And you could actually see the cultural shift. Although I was 10 years old when I got the Buzzcocks record and bought everybody's record after that, I felt that I'd missed out on punk, obviously, because I was just that little bit too young. But this was like an absolute kind of cultural shift from what I'd known and what everyone had known before. And everyone just started dancing from then on, really. the band got a record deal. We toured all over the world and got to meet some really amazing people.
So I remember going to the Hacienda sort of like fairly early on. And, you know, my experience in Manchester before that was like, you know, Joy Division, Buzzcocks, punk, you know, it was like, it was harder. So where was the point where all of that changed? Because that's probably when me and Budgie had just left at that point. So,
So I think the Hacienda was bought by New Order and according to legend, you know, everything that Joy Division had made, you know, so Love Will Tear Us Apart, all the big hits had helped to get this nightclub going. And I guess it just got more, I guess the sun came out in Manchester as opposed to it just being kind of, you know, cloudy all the time. And all of a sudden, and all of a sudden people were waving like glow sticks and it just changed from kind of, you know, everything that we still know and love and everything, but to just something that was a bit more modern psychedelic, I suppose.
Right.
It doesn't sound that new now, saying it, because things come and go all the time anyway, don't they? And, you know. Yeah.
I mean, we started off as a sort of like psychedelic punk band, really. You know, that's where the you get a connection, you know, that's where I understand it.
And like the top, you know, I mean, is about as psychedelic as you can get, you know. And one of my favorite records, you know. So, you know.
Oh yes, absolutely. Yeah, that was to do with Mushroom.
Oh, was it?
Yeah. Well, it was Andy Anderson. I can say it now because, you know, bless his soul, he's passed away. Mr. A, he would brew up like Mushroom tea, you know, before the sessions. I think I can say that. So I remember it was a very transitional album for us, you know, because we'd done the pornography tour and everything kind of fell apart. And then we'd done a few singles that nobody thought we could do, like pop singles. And
that's when I first started really getting, I mean, you know, I got into you at first really because of like The Walk and Love Cats. And then, you know, I mean, I'm obsessed by pornography because it's so mysterious to me. But, you know, I really started collecting your records from the top onwards, really.
Yeah, the top was really, you know, it was, like I say, a transitional, and there was just the two of us. You know, Andy came along as well. Andy playing the drums, and I did some keyboard bits and, you know, pottered about and stuff. And we did it at Martin Russian studio out in Reading, you know, at the beginning of the Thames sort of thing. So it was in a little country village, and we stayed down the hill in this pub. I still have the key to the pub now. You know, I could walk in it and open the front door and go in. But, you know, it was kind of weird because we'd be, you know, Robert, you know, I'm sure it's no surprise, Robert's pretty nocturnal, right? So we'd be working late in the day, and we come back to the pub where we were all living, you know, like I had one room, Robert had one room, Andy had a room. And the landlord said to us, okay, give us the key. So he gave me the key. And he said, when you come in, he said, you can help yourself to anything behind the bar. He said, just write it down, you know, and then...
write it down?
Courtesy bar.
Bad idea.
I hope you kept that as well as the key, you know, the pad where you wrote things down.
Yeah.
Well, we're just going to have a little drink now. We're going to have three bottles of...
But the worst part was, I think as far as the locals were concerned, was that several mornings we'd still be there as they started to open the pub up for, you know, the morning session.
That's when you know you've gone too far, isn't it?
Well, yeah. And we'd go, the landlord would come down by that time and go, oh, you here, boys? You just got up? And we're like, no, we haven't been to bed yet. Can we have some breakfast? You know, and he made breakfast. And the local, you know, in English pubs, there's always one geezer that comes in first thing in the morning. And that's his job. You know, he's like, he's got to be the first one in the pub in the morning, right? And we had this guy, he come in, and we're all sitting there with pints of bitter, you know, having eggs and bacon or whatever, you know, and he looked very upset that he wasn't the first person in the pub that morning, you know.
He's not the old bloke stirring at the sea, is he?
No, that's Johnny Buttons, who we found on a beach down in Brighton somewhere, and we filmed him, right? And Andy Vella and Pearl Thompson, they did all the artwork for that, so they filmed him down on the beach. And for the video of it, right? And it was an old fisherman, right? Johnny Buttons. And we invited him to London to come and see the video, you know, like, oh, come and see the video. And so he sat in a chair, watched the video. And at the end of it, he was quite, you know, sort of taciturn guy, didn't say much. And he said, my wife always said I was an ugly bastard. And now I know I am.
How long have you been in Berlin then?
Way too long to not know the language.
Right. Oh, right. Okay. Yeah.
Yep. It's 10, 11 years
wow.
now.
Wow.
My life has changed since I've been here. I'm married again and two children.
Wow. Congratulations.
Who knows what happens next? You know, I thought I was going to have to move to LA like you did.
Yeah.
And like Lowell did, because that was the only place that would have me.
I felt that for sure.
Yeah, because everything else, I'd burnt all the bridges, and the band had gone, and the marriage had gone, and I was heading to LA.
Right. Yeah.
And I realized I pined for it because I used to go there and play a lot. You know, we used to gig there a lot. We gigged around America a lot. Berlin, I don't know how it came to be here. It was just following the footsteps of friends.
Yeah.
For us, you know, I always think about that Bowie song, you know, I've lived all over the world, I've left every place, you know, that's the line, right? But I think to myself, what is it that drives musicians especially to live that sort of wandering life and go? Is it because we feel outside of things, or is it because we feel part of different things? I mean, what do you think?
Well, both of those things, or because you kind of like live out of a suitcase, you don't feel settled, and then you actually grow into it and you like it. Or maybe it starts a lot earlier than that, I don't know.
Yeah, I think for me it started earlier. I sort of, you know, I saw things on TV and I thought, I want to go to those places. You know, when I first got to New York, first thing I remember, you know, I was like 21 and driving down the you know, into Manhattan and thinking, it just looks like a movie. It looks like a film, you know?
It was funny. Now you've said that. I remember sort of like having our first record out and the boss of the label saying, would you mind going to New York? And I was like, what? You know, I just had no, it's like, I had no concept at all of ever even really going there. And I said, yeah, I'd love to hear, what's it like? He said, it's just like you see on the telly. I said, okay, I'm going.
Do you have fond memories of living in Los Angeles?
I do, yeah. I lived in Beechwood Canyon, and so it was out of the way, but a nice walk if I fancied it, you know, to like Sunset Boulevard, where, you know, I feel it's part of my makeup, really. I'd always just felt like I was living out a childhood fantasy.
That's what it was for me as well. I felt like a childhood fantasy.
Yeah, exactly.
I see one photograph of me and the first tour the Banshees did that I was on. And so it was me, Severin, Susie, and McGeoch, and all the crew, all on this like beat up old bus. And we stopped in the desert, and Ray Stevenson took some photographs. And I'm rolling a cigarette with next to a yucca cactus thing, you know, with the kind of engineer's boots and the Levi's tucked in. I thought, this is what you two ended up doing. We all wanted to look like we were like born on the road, out on the trail, you know, with no home and no address. And it was like a fantasy world out there. Was there a moment in time that kind of, if you like, I always liken it to the kind of shuttle leaving orbit, where you kind of you're off by a couple of degrees and you end up going total different direction. You overshoot the moon completely. But was there some event that happened early on that sends you on your way, that you go, I'm going to be leaving here? You know, I don't know how, but I need to get out. Was there a moment like that for you, Tim?
Well, just watching Top of the Pops when I was a kid, and then the Tube, you know, and I always think that I stumbled into it, but my mum said that I told her I was going to be involved in music when I was like really young, you know, and that's all that I knew that I was going to do. But yeah. I don't remember saying that, you know. But
do you have any? Was your family just you, or was do you have brother and sisters?
Me and my sister. But there's no real. I mean, my mum's youngest brother, who was only a couple of years older than me, sounds a bit odd, but you know, she was the eldest out of six, and the youngest was only a few years older than me, and he had lots of records, Jethro Tull and, you know, some Led Zeppelin posters on his wall. And he taught me how to play bass a little bit. And then I got into punk music, you know. So it was easier to learn. Warhead by UK Subs was a lot easier than, you know, than...
anything off stand-up.
So what was it? What was Slits like then, Budgie?
You don't mind
me changing the subject.
I can't imagine, understand, really. It was all chance. It was pure fate and chance that I ended up... The band I was in, the Spitfire Boys, with Paul Rutherford and two other guys from St. Helens who knocked on my door. But we went to London a couple of times. Paul got on with Ariana. We were staying at some house. We'd kind of become friends with the Slits. We opened for them at the Covent Garden Rock Garden.
Yeah.
When there was about, I think we outnumbered the audience, you know. they basically knew that they couldn't make the album they wanted without a drummer that would play the same beat for more than 30 seconds.
Yeah.
So, so that's how I met the Slits. And my audition comprised of knocking on Nora, Ariana's mum.
Yeah, mum, yeah.
And Ariana appeared like in a t-shirt and knickers and just proceeded to play me a record collection. And I just sat there going, oh, she rocks like me when I'm playing, listen to music. She was just like manically rocking backwards and forwards on a sofa and giggling at me. And I'm going, it's like, isn't it great? I was going like, yeah, it's great. I love all this music. So next thing I'm in the band. Have we all had a run-in with the wretched booze? We have, haven't we? I think we have. Booze and all the stuff that goes with it.
It's part for the course, right?
Yeah.
It sort of got me by surprise. Somehow it creeps up on you, doesn't it?
Certainly does, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I was kind of okay until like 2003, 2004. And then I actually gave up in 2006, so... But I didn't, you know, I was all right up until that point, really. But then I just kind of put a load of weight on and sort of just couldn't even rehearse without drinking a bottle of wine, really. You know, I mean, that's just to even rehearse. And then, but I couldn't sing during a gig, so I had to work it out somehow. But
we managed never to, you know, we never went on stage drunk or anywhere near it. We'd have like one drink, like... It, amazingly, me, Severin and McGeoch would meet for like a vodka or something, and drink it quick before Susie came down.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's okay, just waiting for you. So, right. Let's go to the gig now. I'm feeling a bit kind of okay. But it was only afterwards we got started. But drink for me was like, if there was like, me and Susie would follow the recording to its bitter end, you know.
Right.
And it was the only time that we could, if you like, be alone, but it'd be okay, was in the cutting room. And I'd go down the cutting room. I used to go everywhere with a plastic bag of Frascati.
Oh, my God.
The white, almost sparkling Italian wine. And poor cutting engineer is going like, oh, no, Budgie's here again. You know, they sit at the back and clink. Clunk, clink. Sounds great. Yeah, sounds great. But really, it was like, it was the, like... Life, the party was wherever we could take it and make it.
Because
otherwise you'd have to hang out with all these people that were going like, "Hey, Susie, do you want to come out? You know, blah blah, or have a fight, you know, something like that."
Yeah.
I don't know. You end up in a kind of, I don't know, like a world that nobody else can get into and you can't get out of.
Yeah.
You can't, well, I think that's the truth, the last bit. You can't get out of it, and that was the worst thing. I mean, for us, you know, by the time we got to the end of pornography, if we just had stopped for about 6 months, we'd have been fine, you know, but we still sort of kept going. And even though it was just like the two of us at that point, we were still kind of nuts, you know. And I think, you know, then we started to go back on tour and stuff, and it got worse. I mean, touring, we did a lot of touring.
You mustn't forget that, Lol, that Robert did have a little rest. He came and joined the Banshees,
He did, yeah.
Well, yeah, that was it. that was why he was doing the top. He would come back from Banshee sessions and come down to visit me and carry on, you know, doing the top. So he
well
was
rested,
like,
well yeah. rested from the Banshees. You know, because we were really productive, making lots of cocktails.
Yeah.
We were sitting in Angel Studios in Upper Street, having not written a song.
Which album's this for?
Hoping for Hyena.
Yes.
Yeah. Hyena. We the Creatures had just done Feast, I think.
Yeah. Good record.
And Severin and Robert had just done the Glove album.
Glove.
And we came together almost like in the studio and saying, well, we should get on with that Banshees album now.
So the Angel was did you do Hyena with Hedges? Was that?
Yeah, we were the first band in the Angel Studios,
because we did Head in the Door after that.
In that same, he just didn't. Robert didn't want to leave the studio after that wonderful experience. No,
that's right. That was it. But did he have the Sky Electric going around the studio? Because we Head on the Door, that's the thing I remember the most. We'd have this Sky Electric going around the whole of that big room.
That's the model racing car.
Yes.
Electric racing car things.
Yes. Right, electric racing car. But we'd fill them up with IPA, you know, like alcohol, and turn all the lights off and set them alight, you know, so they would go round and round.
Can we just explain what IPA is? Do you have that in
have it in Manchester, yeah.
Isopropyl alcohol, yeah. Well, I studied chemistry, right? So that's isopropyl alcohol for you.
There's a young lady came down the studio and was attacking a Fender Jaguar with like whittling knife and making beads and things. Wow. And it, ruining the guitar. Yeah. You know, but it was art. Yeah. It was art. I was spinning cymbals around like big pennies, you know, on the floor of the studio until he went, going, oh, great sound.
Yeah.
Severin was having a new bass made. It was like some guys coming down like, well, would you like the mother of pearl inlay?
Oh my goodness.
There was a moment with Robert and his sister sitting at the harpsichord playing Dear Prudence.
Right, Janet.
Wow. Yes. And I remember the image of the, like, because we'd done all the backing track and everything was on there, and this, the harpsichord was almost the finishing touch.
Yeah.
We really didn't seem prepared for this, and yet, you know, out of chaos, it was sort of, it didn't seem an album that had a single, but it had a lot of great moments in it, you know. We were allowed to make those albums.
Yeah, I mean, time in the studio, I mean, we did 6 months for our third album, and then nine months for our fourth album, and it was a reasonable studio, the price, you know. So it wasn't and it was in a residential one in Wales, we just lived there and made music, and it was just felt like we were the Rolling Stones doing Exile on Main Street or something like that, and just got like living the life, and it was amazing. Right. I don't know. I think we could probably have done them in 3 weeks, but
I suppose it's the theory like that Can had, where they really clocked into it very early to make their own studio space, so that they wouldn't have to pay anybody.
Yeah,
we never worked that one out, I don't think. My teaching gig comes to an end this week, really. I'm going to try and haul myself up somewhere and write my proper proposal for the memoir I want to write.
Yeah.
And it's kind of daunting, and you've been there, I know.
Yes, I enjoyed it. Well, I mean, for a book, I mean, I had somebody who wanted me to write one, and I thought about it, but they were only fleeting thoughts. And and he just kept taking me to this... to this really nice private club on Dean Street, Quo Vada, I think it was, and they had great coffee and great cake, and I just thought, I'll think about it a bit more, and he just kept taking me, and I was like, okay, I'll do one, and then I handed my first draft in. It was 30,000 words, all in capital letters and no punctuation.
That's great.
So we kind of started, and then he asked if I wanted to have a ghostwriter, and I said, yeah, may as well, and because I didn't know any different. And so I met a couple of ghostwriters, got long story short, none of it worked, and I just came to the conclusion that, you know, if I'd done 30,000, I could do 80. I could learn how to punctuate, and with a bit of help and a bit of guidance from the editor, I managed to get a decent memoir.
Yeah,
that's pretty much the story that I have. You know, I never had a ghost writer. I had some help, you know, with a good editor.
Yeah,
that makes that makes some difference. But I was the same as, you know, I'd write like long rambling sentences. They go, well, you know, you could chop this one into three bits. Let's chop this one into three bits.
And exactly. Like, and then elaborate on sections of it and all that. Yeah. And it was really, I really enjoyed it in the end. So much so that I did more, you know.
You've got three books, right?
Yeah, and I'm now working on a fourth, which is the Listening Party book that you've both, obviously, right. both been heavily involved in. And I need to ask Budgie if he would allow me permissions to use his tweets in the book. Lol's already said yes. Oh, yes. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Because I did send you an email and I didn't get a response. So I thought,
I must apologize, but don't worry. Please go ahead.
Oh, that's so great. Yeah. So basically, you know, my royalties and a huge donation from DK Books are giving the money to Music Venue Trust, which is really great. So it kind of means that everyone who, you know, basically, I'm using everyone's tweets to put into a book under the banner of the Listening Party, but it's actually helping a lot of people. So who've been affected by COVID, I thought that'd be a wise thing to do with it, make everyone feel who contributed good about it.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, the Listening Party has been like a sort of phenomenon. You know, I mean, I got to say, personally, I feel like you single-handedly saved music in the last year or so with it all, you know.
Well, I think we you know, maybe the platform as a very early idea was helpful, you know, but everybody getting on board and helping, you know like your good selves and everyone else who's taking part in it, you know, Iron Maiden, Paul McCartney, you know, Susie and the Banshees, The Cure, you know, Everybody's done it.
It's funny because in some ways it's made more of a community than it was before, you know?
Exactly. Yeah, people were really, really great about it. And I think everyone felt that they were helping, keeping people motivated through the dark nights, you know, especially like on the second lockdown around about Christmas time and stuff. It was really difficult winter and, you know, no one having anything to do and nobody having and if everybody who lived together in the same house didn't have the same music taste, so you know, they could, you know, some people could just go put some headphones on, watch their favorite artist tweet and listen to a record together, you know. It felt like it was together.
Yeah, that was the amazing thing for me. I mean, I don't know how you felt, Budgie, but I felt when I did it was It was like a sort of remote gig in a way, you know, because I knew that people were online and, you know, I was listening to something, maybe I hadn't listened to it for a while, and I just had to kind of remember, oh, yeah, that thing happened here and that thing happened there. I mean, you know, after it finishes, you know, maybe the album's like 40 minutes long. After it finishes, I was online for about 5 hours, you know, just talking up with people and sent these questions, you know. But it was wonderful. It was a wonderful experience, you know.
Yeah, so. It just adds, it's kind of sharing something that I guess you don't get to share in a music magazine and things like that, you know, because there's not enough time or there's, you know, more people in the band or something like that. Get your own personal archive and sort of share it. It's a beautiful thing for people to see and for artists to do.
Yeah, I'm sure I found this with my first book is that people fall into sort of two categories. You know, they either want to know sort of like the emotional side of how you came to be in a band and make music and stuff. But they also want to know the little things behind it all that you wouldn't normally see, like you say, like the photos that are in your private collection and stuff. So it was a way to give that, and people are very appreciative of that. I found, which was kind of amazing to me because I'm like, oh, it's just an old shot of the two of us together sitting somewhere, you know. And it's like, wow, they liked it, you know. So that was cool.
I like the experience of reliving the album with people, this revisiting a moment in, you know, be it the band or the life, what was happening, you know, mine was like, I think we were celebrating 40 years anniversary of Kaleidoscope, which is just in itself is mind boggling, because I just arrived and not long since arrived in London. And it was my introduction to the band. I joined during the making of an album. And so to share that moment, because back in the time when it was released, all you're doing is talking about it as a band, as a promotional thing, as a tour coming up, as a guitarist you just found and you've learned the songs and you're going to go and play them for the first time. But with all the years that have passed, the hindsight thing, it's more personal in a way. The band's gone already. And so you're actually revisiting as a kind of a fan in a way, because I've not listened to it for such a long time.
Yeah.
Did you find that with other people? Is that the way people kind of ended up in the past?
Well, I mean, when you were talking about it then, I just get shivers down my spine because, I mean, that record meant, you know, such a lot to me. You know, I bought Christine, Happy House, you know, when they came out as singles, you know, I mean, I was like, I was there as a fan, you know, waiting for more. That's it's so great to see you.
It's great to see you too, yes. Tim. Thank you.
And thank you for everything and have a great day.
Lol, it's curious question time. You've got all the questions tonight, by the way. I'm liking this. It's like you become the quiz master.
Well, it's only because I got the computer with all the questions on. But
does anybody out there remember Bamber Gascoigne? You wouldn't in America, but it's an old English quiz. University Challenge.
Yes, right.
Asking the questions, Lawrence Tolhurst.
Okay, post-punk drumming. That's what this question's on, right? And it's from Gary Clark, and I know Gary Clark because
he could be a relation to me.
Yeah, he could. He has a Cure tribute band called the Cure Heads.
Is he Gary Clark with or without an E?
He's like yourself with an E.
With an E,
yeah.
He would have been called, if he was in the north of England, Clarky. Yeah.
Clarky, okay.
Clarky.
So Clarky says, What is it about post-punk music that still has the public, not just the people in the know industry, discussing musicians by name? Very rarely these days does anyone talk about individual musicians. However, when various genres around the time of post-punk are discussed, various names, not just the vocalists, crop up. Khan, Budgie, Tolhurst, Hook, Severin, Captain, Jones, Ash, Aston, Duffy, Gallup, Marr, et al. The list goes on and on.
Mm.
Why did, here's his question now, why did the post-punk era spawn so many instantly recognisable players? There were one or two in the 90s, Bernard Butler for one, but why does the panel think, I guess that's it, we are the panel.
Does the team think?
That most George Ezra or Ed Sheeran fans couldn't tell you who plays in their band?
You see, I suppose it's that everybody was as important as everybody else.
That's right. Punk, egalitarian kind of musical time. Yeah.
We coined it. We took it off the French. Egalité, fraternité, liberté. And we made it into, maybe there wasn't very many of us.
I think it's probably a bit of both, isn't it? There wasn't that many of us because there was probably at any one time, and I'm sure we'll get some replies about this, but to my way of thinking, there was probably no more than 20 or 30, you know, bands coming up at any one time in those early years. You know, maybe, you know, it would change constantly, but I don't really think that if you'd sat down and said, name me, you know, 20 bands right now that are influenced, you know.
Mind you, yeah. Everybody's had like 40 odd years to remember these names as well.
That's a very good point, yeah.
And also, Unlike the many of the say the guys who play with who did you mention Ed Sheeran or something? There's nobody playing with Ed Sheeran. He's on his own. He's the guy's a one man band, right? But the people today and in the 90s as well would be more inclined to be very good at their instrument, and would be known for playing, you know, the bass or the drums. And quite often we were just, you know, bluffing.
Yeah.
And we became kind of good at what we do, but really it was everybody who could make the most noise.
Yes, but also I think, and that's absolutely correct, I think also that there's a point that Gary kind of sort of brings up, but it's like it was a time of immense change. So therefore anybody involved in it had an identity. Punk was a pivotal moment. So for that to be a pivotal moment, the people that were involved in it, you know, it was a great change. So I think that's stuck in people's minds. Also, I suppose if you go back to like the 60s and you take, you know, the change with the, you know, what would be out here, the you know, the British invasion, that there's lots of people that remember the names of all the people in all of those bands then as well.
Except, you know, could you remember anybody else in the Moody Blues, for instance, or
Justin,
apart from Justin Hayward?
Yeah, Justin Hayward.
You know, or could you name anybody in Haircut 100?
Nick Hayward.
He might be Justin's little brother. You never know. Yeah. But the thing is, we can remember certain ones because they used to pick the best musicians. They used to kind of, you know, let's get Jimmy Page in. Let's nick him from the Yardbirds and put him in this band.
Yeah.
Whereas I just looked at this book of photographs from 1977 to 82 around Liverpool. Right. And everybody in the book is a character, whether they're in a band or not.
Yeah.
And if you wanted a bass player, a guitarist, first of all, you'd look around seeing who was the best looking person and then ask them, do you play guitar?
Yeah, that was very true to a greater or lesser extent. It was such a cultural revolution that you had to be, you know, as they would say nowadays, OG. You had to be the originator of whatever you were doing. And if you were doing that, then you get in. And I guess that means that as personalities over the years, things have become that much more amplified in the public's imagination.
Yeah.
And thank goodness for that, for us.
We're all characters.
Okay.
I can see you're studying the next question.
So next question is a little contentious, but we like those ones from time to time because they send us off on trains of thought.
Ooh, like a bit of contentious.
Rama Giafari says, hi guys, thanks for doing this. Budgie, where were you when you went missing in New York City? So that's the first part of the question, right?
I have a stunned face. a face of non-recollection. Carry on.
Lol. Did you ask not to be drumming and switch to keys, or did Robert ask you? Thanks, guys. Rama.
Thanks, Rama.
Yeah.
Now, Rama, you need to help me out here. I think we need a kind of bit of a verification of the date. You know, which, what time, what day, what year in New York City? I do remember. There are several moments when I may have lost my way in New York City.
It's easy to do.
Do any of them jump out particularly? I think there was I do recall running rampant through New York City with Adam Peters. Adam, who was part of, with Ben Watkins, my old mate Ben, part of, who's now Juno Reactor. They were the Flower Pot Men at the time.
Oh, I know Adam. Mm. Yes, I know Adam.
I can't really go on from that. We were running and I ended up in a skip, I think. Which was rather comfortable at the time.
Yeah.
Yeah. At least it slowed me down a bit.
Yeah, those dumpsters, which is what they call skips here, are very...
A dumpster.
Yeah, they're very comfortable, I understand.
Depends what's in them, yeah.
Well, it depends what's in them and how high you have fallen to get in those things, you know, so...
I'm just trying to think if there was a moment, you know, a high point. I'm not sure it can be a high point, you know, of going missing in New York City.
Yeah.
I always tried to be missing.
Right.
You know, it was a thing. If you could be missed from a tour.
Yeah.
Presuming you're on tour at the time. It was very difficult to break off from the touring party. And I think a lot of the antics were to do with getting some, I don't know, space. Yeah. Space away from everything.
Right. That leads us very neatly onto the second part of Rama's question. Did I change because I was asked? Was I pushed or did I fall, I suppose, is the question. And the answer really is six of one and half a dozen of the other. To a certain point, for me, there came a point where there was, because I was not classically trained as a drummer, there was a much bigger learning curve for me to get past certain things to make things more poly-interesting, I guess, is probably the term, although that could be misconstrued, I suppose. But I wanted to make it, you know, a little more interesting. And I felt the easiest way to do that was probably the quickest way to do it. Because you have to remember back then we were doing like an album a year and it was like bang, 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 really fast. So there's no way anybody could learn something a little more complex within, you know, a space of 6 months or a year and do it legitimately. So I thought, well, but I can hear these things in my head. How about I program them? Because all the, you know, the technology was coming out to do that. How about I do that? Because, you know, I'm a modern man. I'm not afraid of drum machines and stuff. And so I went more that way. And gradually it became obvious, well, that would be like a really good thing to do. And then from there, I can go on to keyboards, which are, you know, very approachable for most drummers because they're a rhythm instrument. You know, you look at the orchestra, you see the timpani with the piano forte. That's exactly the relationship. So, and of course, also in the back of my mind was, hey, then I'll be at the front of the stage as well. So, you know, that was kind of good. My first love is still drums, you know, because I love the physicality of it. And it's much more aligned with the life force, you know, to be actually, you know, playing something that makes your body feel different as you're doing it. Whereas, you know, keyboards and synths and drum machines are much more, you know, cerebral, and I'm attracted to both sides to make it work.
It's interesting. I suppose we, both of us, we were not, as you say, we didn't come at drumming, from I must play the drums. It's something I've always wanted to do. It was certainly what I enjoyed doing. But it wasn't,
yeah.
I didn't know what I was going to do when I started being involved in music.
Right. I was always of the opinion that I was an artistic person, and whatever it required of the song or the music to do, whatever I could contribute would be what I wanted to do. Yeah. And I think you're very much like that as well. I mean, I know with the Creatures how much, yeah, how many different instruments you played on the Creatures recordings. And
I say I did, I hit, struck, or blew all the instruments on the Creatures recordings.
Right.
But I can't play any of those instruments. I could never sit down in the bar or in your, you know,
right.
around your mate's house and, oh, knock your tuner on the marimba.
Yeah, yeah, give us a tune, budge. Yeah.
No, I'm not that person. I don't sit around and play drums. I don't learn rudiments. I don't try and master the instrument. I let it, I hopefully wait until it tells me what to do, you know.
Right.
Or I hear something and go, how on earth do I do that?
It was, I even went as far as learning hexadecimal to program the Ensoniq Mirage, which was, you know, that's like, you probably need, well, you don't need a PhD, but you might need a degree in physics to understand some of that stuff. And
you went a step further than I ever would.
Well, you know, I think we have a very similar approach to the whole thing, and it's telling. I've always maintained that there are two types of musicians in the world. There are musicians of our ilk, and there are musicians like my sister who teaches piano, who can play most anything you put in front of her, but cannot really think about playing something of her own composition, perhaps. You
have to be a good performer. You have to know a little bit about the instrument, but you also have to know your way around New York. You have to know how to get lost and how to find your way back to the hotel.
Yeah,
these are things you can't teach a person.
You have to know how to get lost a little bit to be able to make something musical. You know, you have to leave you behind a little bit and your analytical mind and just go, wow, that just sounds really good doing that. I'm just going to do it, whether or not it's musically correct, you know.
Yeah.
Curious Creatures is created and presented by Vol Tolhurst and Budgie.
Producer, Joe Wong.
Producer and audio designer, Dan Didier.
Executive producer, Mark Cates.
Associate producer, Sophie Spare.
Social media, Margie Taylor.
Art and logo design, Justin Thomas K.
Music production, Jackknife Lee.
Curious Creatures is on the web, and you can access us at www.curiouscreaturespodcast.com.
I love saying www.curiouscreaturespodcast.com. And you can reach us on Instagram, Facebook, at Curious Creatures Official, Twitter, at Cure Creatures.
To find more of the best music podcasts, visit doubleelvis.com or follow at doubleelvis on Instagram and at doubleelvisfm on Twitter. Curious Creatures is a production of LXB LLC 2021.